podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Tour Live, Neil Atkinson with Damien Cavana, Emma Sanders and veteran of the Time Wars, John Gibbons, in order to look back at the game against Atletico Madrid, look ahead to the game against West Ham United, get your comments in all the way through this. Hope you enjoy it. It's also a podcast. So coming up on that podcast, we've got Ryan Baldy, Michael McCambridge and Rachel Furness talking to Harriet Pryor. Marvellous stuff. Great marriage there, John, of the North and South East. Well, on that one.
Well, I mean, it's international, isn't it? The segments today. Both sets of the pond, sides of the pond.
Both sides of the pond. Yep. So they are all to come for you. But we are going to start off talking about Liverpool's excellent performance against Atletico Madrid. El Grupo del Morte, Damien. Mm. And yet Liverpool do it with two games to spare. It's not what anyone saw coming, and I'll include myself in that. I was all right with the draw when it came out. I thought, no, that'll suit us. I felt United's draw was stickier, and that's the way it's proven so far. You know, a lot of sides there that are happy to play as the smaller team. Liverpool have played, though, like a big team in the big competition, and they've done the big job early.
Oh, we were nails, weren't we? What a marvellous performance that was last night. Absolutely great. All that we wanted, and all that we know we're capable of. And while we've flickered a little bit in the Premier League, and I'm nitpicking there with, you know, where we are in the league and that, Champions League, we've just done the business, haven't we? I remember saying a little, I can't remember what show it was on, a group of death, yeah, for everybody else. Because we're going through and two of them's going out. That's how I felt about it. But Liverpool played like that. Liverpool came out and went, we've done all this before. And what I really have really enjoyed about the Atletico thing is we had hard lines when they knocked us out. A while ago, but it was like a nice way to go out in the fact that you throw everything at them, and they ride the luck, and the goalie plays great, and the atmosphere is marvellous. And I know it was a very sad occasion, and, you know, very difficult to think of it in a football context. But if you think about the game itself, it was like that's how champions need to go out when they're banging at the door and all this. Well, Liverpool have learned a bit there, haven't they? And they thought, this isn't happening again. Yous are getting it, and we've put them to the sword, good style. The results have been fantastic. Spanish champions. Not good enough to beat Liverpool. We were just great all over the pitch.
We were much the better side. In to sort of take the long view on the group, Emma, Liverpool are significantly better at Anfield than Milan. They, in the end, absolutely dominate Porto. There is a very sticky hour, if we're all honest, and we can be honest, in Madrid. But Liverpool weather it and come out the other side, showing so much nous and so much needle through that game in Madrid. And then last night again, Liverpool just utterly dominant. I don't think you can overstate how well Liverpool have played to get on 12 points. It has not been easy. Every single one of those games has been a challenge, and yet there Liverpool are 12 points and through.
And yet they kind of made it look easy as well. You look back to kind of 2016 when Jurgen Klopp came in, and even, I guess, maybe up until 2018-19, you never really felt that Liverpool were quite at that level where they could just go and ease through groups in the Champions League. In the way that they have done in obviously this year and the year that they won it. So I think that has been a progression under Jurgen Klopp, is that they now feel like they are absolutely the best in Europe and they're playing like it. Mm-hmm. And they go into games with that kind of mentality and that kind of attitude. And I think Damien's right. The way that they looked at the group was it's not a group of death. It's if we can put down a marker early on and kind of get up to the levels that we want to be playing at in the knockout stages, because that's where Liverpool always thought that they would be, then that's only going to put us in good stead for, you know, further down the line in the competition. And I think, you know, other teams now that are coming through maybe slightly easier groups, people might say that Chelsea have had an easier group in comparison to Liverpool. Liverpool are already at the levels that they need to be to reach the latter stages of the competition. And those other teams might need to take a little bit of time to get to there. So I think it's an advantage for Liverpool.
The maturity of it, John, and the grabbing of the challenge that's in front of you is what most impressed me about the way in which they've gone about the business in these four games. They look like, I think, like European royalty. We often use that line. Mm. But as Emma says, that's something you often grow into through a competition. Now, you know, the thing that's always in the back of your mind, this is there's such a thing as peaking too early, but I don't think there is. Even thinking about when they went through, remember, it went to the last game against Salzburg, but they just sort of turned up with a certain level of assurance. And they've taken that level of assurance and they've put it in every single one of these games when they've needed it, because they haven't been all straightforward and easy. They've got themselves into a little bit of bother, but the assurance and the maturity is what's impressed me.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. And I think last night, you know, they start as well, I thought, but we get the goal. And that's what, you know, the top teams do, don't they? You know, they had a bit of a flurry, you know, not no sort of big chances, but they were attacking, certainly. And then, boom, the moment of real quality comes from Trent Alexander-Arnold's right button, foot, and Diogo, you know, is there to sort of put it in. And then from there, you know, we were just happy to play the game on our terms, really. And I included the sending off. I thought the sending off changed the game out there. I thought here it only changed the game in the fact that we were able to just to play the rest of the game completely on our terms, up to and including just seeing out time sort of towards the end, really, and making sure that you know, there was no more sort of injuries or sort of anyone that, because that was the only sort of, you know, negative on the night. But we're in a superb position, and, you know, to beat the Spanish champions home and away is fantastic, you know. But what we did in Porto was incredible as well, and sort of shouldn't be forgotten. And then, you know, AC Milan, that first half an hour was maybe the most scintillating of all. We let them back in almost because we were sort of finding it too easy, but then went on to win it. But that first half hour against Milan was arguably the best we've played all season in terms of a sustained burst. It was absolutely fantastic. So yeah, everyone's talking about Liverpool, I'm sure all eyes are on the Reds, and yeah, looking like if we're not the team to beat them, we're in the top one.
Damien, there is something around the manager talked a lot about it being dramatic. He talked about emotion out there. He talked about the atmosphere out there a lot. Liverpool managed the emotion, I think, of the occasion. Again, both games in different ways, absolutely brilliantly. Liverpool do not get carried away with themselves, I don't think, at any stage. They don't get carried away with the occasion. The talk of, and I'm sure it was knocking around that dressing room, a bit of revenge will have been present. Mm. But they don't even lose themselves in that nonsense. It is a managed, emotional, aggressive, but managed emotional performance.
Yeah, controlled aggression, and that's the key to champions, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not get carried away. If you think about the emotional team that goes all the way to Kiev and comes up very slightly short, it's all emotion, it's all playing like that, putting the heart on the pitch and that. A year later, the team wins, kills the European Cup final after 2 minutes, learns its lessons. This team currently in Europe is playing in that manner of that assuredness, swagger. We've been round this before. We've done the course, we've done the distance. We're the business. And so, well, they've looked at that last year. It must have, well, when was it? It was obviously just before the pandemic. They must have looked at that. It must have hurt them. It must have thought, we were better than them and they got away with it. How do you solve this? What do you do again? What do you think? You know, we got involved in niggles here and there. Well, none of that. No more. None of that. And you could see that that's what they were doing, weren't you? And so what they were trying to do, say, for example, they're trying to goad Mane, and that's the plan, and get him sent off. You know, and that's not the first time a team's tried that. But it's like, I'll tell you what, don't let them follow that line. Let them burn themselves out with it. Let them get carried away. We won't make that mistake. Don't fall for it, because we're better than them. We'll keep our shape. We'll keep our aggression. You will use the crowd to our advantage, you know, if in the home games. It was just so assured all over the pitch. And Liverpool are just really, who were great. You know, they were great enough to win the Spanish League, but, you know, we're better than them. And I just really enjoyed the fact that it was just, you know, let them be niggly. But I tell you what, we'll piss them off even more when we put them to bed. Let them have the sleepless night, not us.
Very much so, Emma. On individual performances, a couple of things in the selection. We're knocking around. In the comments, Barry Higgins says, Ox's ability to take the ball, turn and run at the defence last night was great to see. Listen, you know, I was probably like a lot of other people, you know, Chamberlain was frustrating. I felt a little bit against Brighton. It wasn't just him, but he was a little bit frustrating. And I was having one of those conversations before the match with Rob Gutman, like, we could just do with a little bit more of this, a little bit more of this. You got everything you wanted in the middle of midfield from Chamberlain last night. Everything that you want him to produce in the middle of the park, apart from one or two slightly errant passes after he'd gone past a couple. Everything else about this game was spot on.
Yeah, I think he suits games where the opposition are a bit slower and they give him a bit more time on the ball. And maybe the fact that Atletico were just constantly looking to kill any kind of tempo or any kind of intensity worked in his favour, because he kind of just plays at the same intensity all the time. So the second he picks up the ball, the first thing he's wanting to do is obviously drive it through the middle and drive at players and take players on. And I think that quick kind of burst of pace catches teams like Atletico out when they're just trying to constantly kill the game and constantly slow things down. And so I think that really worked well last night for Liverpool, and it worked well for Oxlade-Chamberlain. But I think that was by far his best game for a very, very long time. I would like to see him do that more consistently. Like you say, he can be quite frustrating. But he's definitely got he's definitely got the quality there, and he gives something a little bit different to Liverpool's midfield. Obviously, he's coming back still from that injury, still not at the heights that he was at before that. So yeah, I hopefully, you know, a good couple of run of games, he can get back to the level that he was, because he's clearly got ability, and when he's on it, he's a real asset for Liverpool.
Yeah, there was a sharpness and a burst of pace that I'd almost forgotten he had, to be honest with you. And so when Emma says, you know, he's not quite back to his best, yeah, I think that's fair. But, you know, you were seeing certainly more than glimpses of it last night. And when he was leaving those midfielders for dead, you know, I was like, oh yeah, remember he used to do that, you know what I mean? And you know, he's able to sort of do that. And it's a game changer if you've got a player who can do that, you know, because you know, they want to sit in, they want to stifle, they want to sort of frustrate you. If you've got someone who's able to just burst past his man, and then suddenly the defensive midfielder's like, well, do I go, or do I need to go over and cover, or do I sort of stay with my man? It just opens up space, and you can see him opening space up for others all night, really, and around him. And I think he did help the forwards, you know, out in terms of, you know, creating sort of a bit more room for them. I thought it was a great performance, but it was just a much balanced midfield throughout, wasn't it? And I think it allowed them all, you know, to shine. You know, I the ratings at the weekend, and I think I said for all the midfielders, you've got to caveat it with they wouldn't have picked the other two to play with them. Well, I think tonight they would have, you know what I mean? Certainly Chamberlain, he'd have been like, yeah, give me some of this, you know. Yeah. Hendo and Fabinho, absolutely brilliant. Yeah. This is a perfect platform for me, you know. Obviously for Jordan as well, you know, it's great, you know, having Fabinho sort of in behind them, but also someone like Chamberlain who can, you know, it's not all on him to sort of add the emphasis as it has been. You know, he's almost been too defensive and too attacking at times, Henderson, this season, in terms of what we've been asking him to do. So it was perfect for him, and obviously for Fabinho, you know, it took about 3 minutes for him to do something brilliant, and he's like, yes, is right.
I must say, by the way, I just think that's a great point by John there. I think he's bang on. I think this midfield three that we've got, you know, we looked at the Brighton game, and we were all over the place, and okay, that wasn't just the midfield, but you know, that's what we're talking about here. But it's like there's two halves to our midfield, and you've got two positions, you know, and basically you need a couple of the experienced guys in there. And if Oxlade's going to flourish, or Keita, or Curtis, or Harvey, you need two of them other old boys in there. And I'm not saying we couldn't get away with it in other games. There'll be games where we can win without, you know, one of the older heads, one of the steadier heads in there, but we need two of them. And when we've got two of them, it gets the best out of the other one.
Yeah.
Because you know, that's to support the attack, to be, you know, up there, up and down, a license to go past the player, to try something, because of the assuredness of who you've got around you. And so it's that combination. It's like two halves of the midfield, but two of them need to be the older heads, and one of them can be anyone. As long as you've got that combination with that, it doesn't matter which ones they are, as long as it's that combination at the highest level. Like I say, I think we can win games without it being that. But when it comes to really, when you really want Liverpool to do the best, it has to be that.
Next thing to go through the match is Tsimikas. A couple of comments have come through about him. It was, I don't think it was that bold a pick by the manager. I think Tsimikas has done relatively well this season. But let's be clear about this. It was a game where it would make a massive difference for Liverpool if they won it. And I thought that he, from minute one, applied himself expertly, really. And up and down the whole line, linking up with his teammates. You know, this is now a footballer who looks not just like he's got a level of ability, which I think we all sort of knew, but he's also built relationships with his teammates now. And last night he was able to exploit them to the full.
Yeah, I couldn't agree anymore. I think the early signs of Tsimikas when he came to Liverpool was that, look, he had a great delivery. You could see he was really good in attacking areas. But like you say, there were times when he just wasn't quite in the right position, or he was sort of, you know, looking over his shoulder to look at the likes of Virgil van Dijk, sort of asking, you know, where do you want me to be? And now that comes a bit more second nature. And Klopp knew that, I think. You know, we always said he needs a bit of time. And I think physically as well, he's much better adapts. You saw him getting really, really stuck in. I actually think he enjoyed the physical side of the game last night. You know, I quite think he's got that kind of grittiness about him now that he perhaps didn't have when he first came in, a bit more aggression. And he's playing with that, both on the ball and off the ball. And yeah, I thought the organisation just across the board last night was really, really good. Obviously, having Fabinho back in midfield just helped settle midfield. The back all worked really nicely together. And obviously, we know how well Trent, Salah and obviously Henderson over on that right-hand side have been linking up really well. But Tsimikas was able to do it on the left with Mane in the first half before he went off. And he just kind of carried that, you know, the whole way through. So, yeah, I think it's really, really good to have that option because, you know, I remember it was only maybe 18 months ago that we were talking about having no depth at fullback, in, you know, the drop off between Trent and Robbo and the likes of Nico Williams and Tsimikas at the time was so big. And yet now Robertson's form has dipped a little bit this season. He's not really up at the standards that he has been in the past. At the moment, he's obviously played a lot of games. So the fact that you can just bring Tsimikas in and it doesn't really feel like there's been much of a drop off at the moment, I think is just really, really good for Klopp.
It's going to lead, and we're going to talk later on, Damien, about the game coming up against West Ham United, but it's going to lead to a manager having a little bit of a decision to make at some point soon. These are good options, good decisions for a manager to have. But if Tsimikas just keeps putting his performances in, and I'm sure that's what the manager will be saying to him, then at some point, effectively, he'll get a game that you wouldn't expect him to get. And Sunday could be the first of them, but there might be a couple of others on the horizon.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was Sunday. I mean, basically, as a manager, you'd just say to your players, wouldn't you, well, put me in a position where I can't not pick you. And Robertson's played so much football. You know, he's not going away anyway. He's still world class. He's still fantastic. But, you know, to get the best out of him, you need a degree of freshness. And then you need a player who can build up some rhythm. I mean, Robertson himself didn't get in the team for a very long time. You know, fullback's a very difficult position to play at Liverpool. More difficult than in any other team, because we place such emphasis and such quality. And then the standard of this lad as a replacement, he's just very competent. That's the first thing. Gets all the basics right. And then he's got that wonder, the left foot that everyone likes talking about, haven't he? You know, we can throw one in, can't he? And then all of a sudden, it's not like Jimmy Milner's covering all the bases and then has to turn back inside on himself and then play a ball inside that can be a bit more predictable or give the opposition half a second. This lad can just like bend it round, you know, and put really quality chances in there. So yeah, I mean, this lad is certainly, if he plays on Sunday, he's earned the right. And it's no bad thing for the best of players, and Robertson certainly is the best of players. To just have that little bit of need a bit of competition here. So I've rested yet, and now I've showed you you're not indispensable. Go and give me your best. I'm going to say the same to you as I've just said to Tsimikas. It's first world problems. It's a fantastic position for us to be in. If we can get it right on the other side at full back, we'll be unstoppable.
Yeah, he's a good player, isn't he? And he's really emerged this season as a genuine option. And whether that's someone just to come in and give Andy Robertson a rest, or whether that's, you know, a little bit more than that, you know, time will tell. I think if he's not yet picked Tsimikas in two or three games on a bounce, as he's been in for one and then sort of out again, so that'll be the sort of, you know, the real sign that Klopp sees him as a first team player, or at least on a sort of a level as Andy Robertson. You know, I saw in a few comments about Robbo just sort of needing a long rest, and I think it shouldn't be underestimated how much the international football takes out of Robertson physically and emotionally. And I think that it's no surprise to me that he's dipped a little bit while there's a lot of international football on. And I think, you know, get the other side of this international break, then there's a bit of a gap, isn't it, that will, I think, it just allow him to sort of get into a bit more of a rhythm with Liverpool. He, you know, he plays almost every minute of every game for Scotland. He captains them. He puts so much into him. That Israel game that I know you watched, Neil, I think he ran sort of two games, basically, didn't he? You know, and he's brilliant, you know, and they're playing three times now that we've, you know, the kind of thing that we've sort of moaned about. And so I think that's just, you know, a bit of a hangover from the summer maybe as well, where he sort of put a lot into that tournament. And so I think, you know, I'm not worried about him at all. I know there was another comment before about, you know, is it a bit of a drop-off for him? You know, is he sort of almost on the way out? I can't remember sort of what it was, but I don't think so. I think, you know, he'd be fine. And as I say, you know, come Christmas when we need all the bodies and everyone, you know, he's going to be better than ever.
Well, I mean, the come Christmas point is a lot of this is about to sort of come live, Emma, for Liverpool. I think for me, one of the things that's interesting is how right Fabinho looked, and yes, it was against 10, but Thiago came on, and you know, you've got to be careful with Thiago, because not only does he do a lot of good things, but everything he does looks so good. I mean, he can pass it 5 yards and make me go, oof. You know, it's absolutely outrageous.
Sometimes he just rolls his foot over the ball, doesn't he? You're like, oh, mate.
Yeah, honestly, how are you allowed to be screened before 9 p.m?
You know, he does it all with perfect hair as well.
And his posture is back up, him looking everywhere. Honestly, it's absolutely filthy. Everything he does, even the most mundane thing, Thiago, Emma. But, you've got to be careful not to get sort of carried away by that, because it's still moving the ball around the pitch and all that sort of stuff. But what I'm coming towards is that Liverpool now, not only do they have two games in Europe that will be as dead rubbers as they can be, the manager talked about the prize money that's at stake, but also within that, we're about to hit the other side of this, a run of games where you want to be able to pick Shimakash. You want to be able to pick two of, as Damien saying before, Thiago, Henderson and Fabinho. You want to be able to rotate them. And it's why the only real downer on the night was the Firmino situation. We still don't have any clarity on it. But Liverpool, we're coming to a point in the season where we want to be spoiled for choice. We want the manager to have choices to make coming into every game, because you back him to make the right ones 95% of the time. And we've got excellent players, so we can have a really fresh crew going all the way through here. The season's opened up lovely after the international break.
Yeah, I think rotation is obviously one thing, like you say, but then also there's the opportunity to build a bit of momentum in terms of consistency with certain personnel as well in the team. The midfield is a brilliant example. The fact that we've hardly seen kind of, you know, I'm not say Chamberlain, for example, combination with Fabinho and Henderson is just one example in midfield. So it's an opportunity for those three, or for the likes of Thiago, Henderson and Fabinho, etc. I think there's kind of two elements to that. Certainly, and I think I was doing the live text on the website at work last night, and I think like I made a comment sort of, you know, maybe the 70th minute or so, that Liverpool, it looked like to me, were making a conscious kind of effort to give Thiago the ball. It was almost like they wanted him to get on it. They wanted him to get the touches and just get his flow going a little bit. And I think that was, you know, all part of this kind of maturity that we spoke about earlier. But also, I think they recognise that further down the line, as you say, those two games and the group games is a really good opportunity for someone like Thiago, who's probably the one that really stands out for me, that you just want to give him the ball as often as he possibly can, just to get that touch back, because the way he plays is so aesthetic, but it is so kind of fine detailed, and it's all those little flicks and the little tricks, and he probably takes a bit longer to get back to his level than maybe, you know, somebody like Henderson, for example, just because of the technicality of what he does. So, yeah, I think those games are a really, really good opportunity to not only rotate, but also just to get those players really up to speed for the latter stages of the competition, and obviously for the Premier League as well.
Last little thing on it, Damien, is I thought that they, having vanquished Atletico Madrid, it was striking to me how much effectively both sides, as soon as the disallowed goal wasn't given, the extent to which I felt both sides decided that'll do us. Yeah, and I think that's something. There's something, even you know, there's much talk around Simeone and his ways and all of this. There's something I think in the Champions League that is reassuringly sane at times. There is a lot of, you know, really elite, the very, very best professionals just decide. And I think in that instance, you see it from Atletico Madrid, they basically decide after the disallowed goal is not given, they just say, you know what, we just don't want to get whacked here. No one wants to get embarrassed. No one wants to get humiliated. And again, talking about the maturity and managing themselves, I think Liverpool show that in the way in which they just keep the ball, move them around a little bit, look to create a thing or two. But there's not a desperation there from Liverpool. They didn't risk anything what they had they held.
Well, we got a bit of practice in at Old Trafford, didn't we? Second half, just strolling rounds and get, you know, playing an occasion and that, yeah. But that's what I'm saying. You know, the ring craft we were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
you know, this team that's done the course and the distance. This is a team that knows its way around. And, you know, like I say, the team that ran to Kiev, the most romantic of teams, might have pressed on last night and might have won 4 or 5, 1 or 2. But in the long run, in preserving energy and knowing how to kill games and taking stuff that you're going to be keeping the good habits and getting muscle memory that you're going to need in knockout matches as well, bringing them to the group matches. And it's just sort of like, we'll put them in that box and we don't need to strain ourselves here, do we, lads? We don't need any injuries. We don't need another sending off. And what we want to do is we want to look like we're in control. We want to show everybody else. And it was like almost an arrogance about it of saying, you know, this is the fiery, this is the dangerous Atleti team, where if it's not going well, they'll drag you down to a level. And Liverpool just said, yeah, for everybody else. That's what they did last night. That, like, when you see them with the little kid and you just sort of, you know, putting on your hand on their head and they can't quite get anywhere near you. That's the box that we had them in last night. And they knew it, because earlier in the game, they thought, well, we've got something to fight for. We couldn't have to do with the results here because, you know, our qualification is in jeopardy here. By the time it was very obvious that the game was won, it was like, yeah, let's not get the goal difference battered. We'll have to fight someone else another day. But we're not fighting here. This is it. We've lost.
Excellent stuff in the comments. Jason Lee, it was his first match he's ever been to last night. Had a brilliant time. I always say it, John, it's always someone's first game. It's one of my favourite things about going to Anfield. Someone's always going for the first time. Last night was a good first one, I'd say, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it was a belter. I remember just been reminded before by someone DMing me, meeting a subscriber from Brooklyn who was over sort of with the family and stuff like that, and they were absolutely, you know, loving it in the Glenbrook last night, as you can imagine. Sort of loving the atmosphere. And yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. It was a boss Anfield night.
It really was. Adam F. Patrick says, this thought Matip was tremendous last night. He was indeed. Liverpool love giving a player a chance to redeem himself. It's one of their favourite things to do. Poor in the first game at Madrid, but given all the opportunities by his manager to prove himself and go a little bit better. Ant Wango says, everyone wanted Shimakas out, Keita out, Origi out, Oxlade out. Takiyat will be proven wrong again. Maybe, but, you know, there's a long way to go in the season, Anton. I think the other thing as well is to always remember the first principle of everything. We're all Reds here. So let's bear that in mind as we rattle right the way through. A little bit on Firmino being out, hopefully back after the international break. Cop on podcast, hello. Say that Thiago is mustard. He is indeed. He is an absolute pleasure to watch. This is Tour Live. Now, if you listen to this as a podcast, what will happen is you will hear me talking to John and Michael McCambridge about a book I've written with Michael McCambridge. It's all a bit weird, but we get through the segment all in one piece. Don't be worried about it too much at all. Also, you'll have Harriet Pryor talking to Rachel Furness and me talking to Ryan Baldy about his book, Everything That You Need, coming up on the Tour Live podcast. Thank you very much indeed for listening to Tour Live today. Neil Atkinson here to sort of guide you through the little bits and pieces that you're going to hear next. So, coming up, you've got Harriet Pryor talking to Rachel Furness. Absolutely fantastic stuff there, and excellent to hear from Rachel. Then you will have me speaking to Ryan Baldy from a couple of weeks back about his tremendous book about young footballers and the way in which academisation works in the league as it stands. It is called The Dream Factory. It's very, very good indeed, and that is on its way to you. But first and foremost, me and John speaking to Michael McCambridge about the book I've written with him called Red Letters, our collaboration going backwards and forwards over the course of the 1920 season. Here's John.
It's John Givens for Tour Live, and I'm delighted to be joined by authors of Red Letters, Neil Atkinson from upstairs, and Michael McCambridge coming at us from Austin, Texas. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
It's a big commute, John.
Well, thanks for having us, John. Thanks to Zoom, Zan, of us are quite commuted. So this book, Red Letters, I'll start with you, Michael, is a series of correspondence between you and Neil that happened over the season. It was something that you undertook without any knowledge of quite what would happen in the season, both in terms of Liverpool victories and results, but also, of course, the world. So why did you originally want to do it, bearing in mind you couldn't kind of, you know, predict what was to happen next?
Well, it's true. We went into it blindly, and sometimes some enterprises are best entered that way. But I had met Neil and you during my visit to Liverpool in March of 2018, researching a book that never came about. And then Neil reached out to me in that summer of 2019 and mentioned that there was this idea that the Liverpool Echo people had cooked up of Neil corresponding with some far-flung supporter to sort of compare experiences of Liverpool right in the red-hot center of it all and Liverpool, say, 5,000 miles away. And I was far enough away to qualify. The idea of that fool's errand was irresistible to me, and I'd really enjoyed the time I'd spent with Neil, and so I was like, sure, yes.
I mean, Michael's been very humble there, saying he qualifies because of his distance away. Yeah. He also qualified because he's one of your favourite sports writers.
Yes, and a lot of other people's favourite sports writers. Like when I said to Chris Walsh, the idea came from John Birchall and Chris Walsh. And, you know, like John I'm not saying we wouldn't have got to it eventually anyway, but like AFQ was John Birchall's idea.
Right?
Yeah. John Birchall said they'll love this. You should try this. And so that, yeah. So, you know, John contributing ideas all over the place. One of the truly great Manchester United supporters of our time, but they had the idea and proposed. And I said, well, I could ask Michael, and Christian was overcome. He loves America's Game. Michael's magnificent book about the NFL. It really is the absolute business. He sent us copies before he came to meet us as like as to brandish his credentials for meeting us, as though A, we don't just meet anyone, and B, it didn't immediately make him hugely overqualified, frankly, for the purpose. So I said, I think Michael might be interested, to Chris, and Chris couldn't believe it. So went to Michael, and Michael was very, very interested. But he was also, the one thing I would say about Michael is he has been very humble there. He was very clear from the outset, this could well become a book. So, you know, what are we doing to ensure that we can have this as a book at the very end of it? And we had those conversations as well to make sure that that was the case. I think there is the thing about, you know, you don't know what it's going to be before you start, but let's have a little bit of context here. They had just won the European Cup, yeah, and they got the 90-odd points. And there was, in the back of my mind, that, you know, in all of our minds, you know, we have to, this is literally part of our job, John, as well as the conversation with Michael as well, is this could well be one hell of a season, the one that's about to come. Obviously, we had no COVID knowledge aforethought. You know, that wasn't in there either, because the subtitle of the book is corresponding amongst the epic season that wouldn't end. And it is this idea of what it all happens when the world collapses around everybody. And that's, in the end, you know, the University of Nebraska have picked it up. And I think in part because what it does capture is sort of a week by week historical record of how people on either side of the Atlantic were perceiving this threat, to be honest with you, this threat to everything. And I'm pleased,
in real time,
yeah. And I'm pleased we've got it, and I'm pleased it's there. And also, I'm pleased that we're doing it not through the eyes, because we're not epidemiologists or whatever the phrase is. We're not politicians. We both write about sport and write about play and write about the fun things in life. And what we're sort of discussing within this is what happens when the fun things in life all just get taken from you, which makes it sound a lot bleaker than it is. But it is that sort of being able to reflect on this thing that you've suddenly lost and understand that. And, you know, I'm really, really pleased and proud of the book, to be honest with you, and where it's ended up. And I'm also just delighted it's a book, but the reason why it's a book is because of Michael and not because of me.
Yeah, well, you mentioned there the real-time element, Michael, and I think that's key to what makes it an important historical document, but also a really, really nice read. And I think we record this the day before Liverpool play Atletico Madrid, and there's lots of people writing things now about the last time we played Atletico Madrid, and people have interviewed me for those pieces. And a lot of people say to you things like, oh, what were you feeling like when you go to the game? And part of you, when people say that, is like, I feel like I should be saying, oh, well, we were nervous and we were going, is the game going to be on? Whereas really, I just wanted to batter them. And you know what I mean? And so we can very often project false memories, and they might be false memories in terms of you kidding yourselves. Do you know what I mean?
So exactly.
It might be kind of like, well, this is, you know, so you're not necessarily telling Porky's all the time. It's just like, you know, you're trying to remember your experiences. You're trying to remember sort of how you felt, and that also always becomes in a bit of a prism of what you know now. Whereas this, you didn't have those. You know, the pros and cons of that. You knew then what you knew then, and you wrote it down, and thank the Lord you did.
For sure. I think that there is the mistake that people make is, and this is not just in sports, but in anything, is to assume that history was inevitable, to assume that it was always going to be that way. And if you took a look at the 2019-2020 table, you might say, oh, it was never a race. It was in the bag. But after 30 years and after all the near misses, all the Christmas holidays when Liverpool were top of the table but didn't follow through, those early months for Neil and I, and this is documented in the book, were just on pins and needles of like, yeah, okay, that was really good, but we really have to keep our focus. We really, you know, what's going to happen in Qatar? Is the Club World Cup going to mess things up? How are we going to do during the holiday fixtures? And that's in the book. And then later on, and this is something else that I'm particularly happy is in there, because I also think it could be lost to history or easily forgotten, is that sense after the Atletico game in March of entering this void. Of never mind how the season is going to end, but if the season is going to end, or if it in fact had already ended. there's a point during one of the letters in April where we're still sort of in this purgatory, where I mentioned to Neil that I think we were experiencing the first gameless month of our lives. Not just no football, no hockey, no basketball, no bowling, no golf, no tennis, nothing. Mm-hmm. And just how bizarre that was for people for whom sports fandom is, you know, the inoperable tumor that it is for all of us, this thing that we carry around with us. So I think that the pandemic obviously made the book more complicated, but I think it ultimately made it more interesting as well.
The idea of the lack of games, but also the stopping of all sport, it's really interesting. It's still something to look back on. It's good within the book, and it's still something I think about all the time, in that, in fact, we have some friends, John, not a huge number, who don't actually have that much interest in sport. And so even within the pandemic there was a lot going on. But one of the things, if we're all frank about it to a degree, our coping mechanism is there's about to be a game again in a minute, no matter what it is, no matter what sport, whether it's cricket, whether it's rugby league, you know, whether it's football, whatever it is, there's about to be another game. And suddenly there's no games. There'll be no games for anybody. And so you've lost that sort of coping mechanism. And the other thing is, I'm pleased Michael mentioned it, we were sort of doing a lot of editing on this book over the summer just gone. And it was whilst this sort of time where there was a lot of chat around how Liverpool got bits of the summer of 2019 wrong, because winning the league was always inevitable, so they should have done this, that, or the other. And genuinely, you know, if there's a reason from a Liverpool supporter's point of view to buy the book, and I'd hope cherish the book, is that what we don't do, and I think the best book post the title win is Melissa Reddy's Believers, which I think is a terrific piece of work. I think it's really, really good. But she writes that framed as, this is how Liverpool achieved the brilliant thing. And you can't help but do that, but end up sort of acting as though, well, the brilliant thing was always going to be achieved.
Yeah.
In the book, as we have it, you know, Michael, we started off in one of the early letters as an exchange where we're arguing over what we think the final points total will be, and Michael's sub 90, and I'm saying I think that both Liverpool and City can go post 90 again. But within that, even, there is this sort of this game by game, oh my God, we've just got away with it. Oh, it's just been another tight one. And how much all of this did feel like it was on a knife edge, because we've forgotten the knife edge. And the knife edge was arguably the most fun part. The fact that we didn't just stay on the knife edge, but we danced our way across it in the end. And we remember the dancing, but we forget the knife edge.
And to add to that, just the one thing to add to that, everything we know about sports and analytics is that teams cannot keep sustaining single goal wins in perpetuity. And there was a point where I and it was like December, where I felt like, I think we've used up all the single goal wins.
Michael, when you were receiving these correspondence and the letters from Neil, what were you most looking forward to sort of reading in them, as someone who was removed from the action in some way?
Oddly enough, I think that what I most valued about Neil's writing was you guys being at Anfield get to experience the game unfiltered. There is this distorting quality of social media in the way we experience sports today. Mm-hmm. And it is layered when you're watching in a pub on TV and everybody's, you know, got their phones out and they're pissing off about, look what somebody said and look what's, you know, and all the haters. And there was the best example would be the Sadio and Mo contretemps early in the season. We experienced it completely differently because I saw all the TV replays and I was like, oh my God, mom and dad are fighting. And Neil in the stadium, didn't notice it at all until he came back and saw the replays. And there were those different perspectives. The one other thing I should mention, I definitely look forward to Neil, but John, you can probably relate to this. Deeply resented Neil's facility to write so well, so quickly.
Oh yeah.
Because as a slow writer myself, as someone who agonizes over draft after draft and whose writing model is basically try to make each succeeding revision suck less than the previous one. The fact that he can just seemingly sit down and spit it out was at times frustrating, though I respect and admire it.
Michael, wait till you've seen him 8 pints in 20 minutes, right? With the most beautiful match review in the corner of a pub half the time while people are shouting at him. That is quite the experience. And also, as someone who writes very much like you, equally frustrating. Just to finish up, Neil, I really like the pictures in the book. And the reason I really like the pictures in the book was because you have to sort of guess where they are. And I think that's a real reminder to all of us that, you know, we're all in different parts and we're all celebrating in different ways and supporting in different ways. But really, we're all essentially just Liverpool fans who are desperate to watch the game together and enjoy it together. And I'd like a game, maybe, of them all laid out where we try and guess where because, you know, because there's you in pubs in Anfield celebrating with people we know. There's Michael's shots of supporters clubs and things like that. And they all just look like they're in the same room.
That's really, really good points, and I couldn't agree more. You know, but the other thing that there is within that as well is a little bit of a reminder that, weirdly, without doing what we do, I wouldn't have very much documented about this season in a really strange way, because I'm not a big pictures person in general, and we don't really have. I mean, you talked really movingly recently on a show, John, about getting a picture with your dad during this season, and I remember it and cherish you talking about it. But, you know, within that, you actually say it's quite hard to take pictures in Anfield, and one of the things we were working with the publisher towards the end was there was a lot of them being absolutely amazed that I don't have a pic. There's not just not pictures of me in Anfield, yeah. And there's not going to be anytime soon. You know what I mean? Unless Propaganda Dave takes a sneaky one. There's not going to be anytime soon, because it's just not sort of part of that wider cultural thing. That said, I think there would have been an unbelievable number of pictures had we all been able to be in the ground in Anfield when they lifted it.
Yeah.
I think that day then there would have been almost like a photo shoot for everyone. There'd have been, everyone would have wanted one more and all of that sort of stuff. But this idea of, you know, and it's worth remembering, one of the key things about the Liverpool supported them, but also all of it, as we often say, we're in the run-up here to West Ham away, and there'll be only 4,000 Liverpool supporters in West Ham away. So the rest of us are all experiencing it, as you've just described it there. We're all in rooms, different rooms, and differently decorated rooms, but all in these rooms looking for that shared experience with one another, looking to have the people around us that we love to watch the match with. And that comes through the book all the way through. You know, Michael's depictions of the people he watches the match with in Austin, the highs and lows, their takes, where they're up to. They're a massive part of the book, because what it does is it places you there, but there could be anywhere. It could be any of the supporters clubs, and we've been lucky to spend time with so many supporters clubs. And for me, one of the big takeaways from the book, in terms of both what me and Michael are doing, but what it is we're depicting and what we're talking about, it's fundamentally entirely a social thing. Yeah. That it all only makes sense when it's social. And this is a book, a long book, about a pandemic and about a football season, but also about the importance of being social.
Yeah, absolutely. Red Letters by Michael McCambridge and Neil Atkinson is out now. It's available to buy worldwide. Will there be a much longer discussion with Neil and Michael coming out in the next month or so? I might just do it now. I've got a taste for it, to be honest with you. But you're not going to hear it now. But you can buy the book now. It is available worldwide, as I said. Red Letters, two fervent LFC supporters correspond through the epic season that wouldn't end.
Last week, I hopped on a train and headed to Manchester for the Women's Euros 2022 draw. With the news that England and Northern Ireland had been drawn in the same group, I got the chance to have a quick catch-up with Liverpool women's player Rachel Furness to get her thoughts on the draw and their chances in the competition. And of course, I managed to sneak in a little chat about how the Reds are getting on and look ahead to their upcoming fixtures. Enjoy!
Hi Rich, I'm from the Anfield Rap, so I've just looked over and I've seen a familiar face, and it's great to see you. So how are you, and how have you found the event today?
I'm really well. I think the event's been fantastic. I mean, the place, they've done great things. I think you've just got to look at who was singing, how it was presented. Everything is, you know, world class, and it really creates the excitement and buzz around the whole tournament, and one of which I can't wait for.
I know it's only 9 months away now, isn't it? And obviously you know now who you'll be facing. It's a really exciting group for you guys, and you've obviously got England. How are you feeling about the draw?
I think any team who would have gotten the draw would have been really difficult. You know, we are the underdogs, but I think the excitement and the buzz and the what we can create around that, playing the host nation, one of the favourites of the tournament, obviously the pressure's on them, but we're really excited. We know the stadiums are going to be packed out, and hopefully there's a lot of the Green and White Army travel over, with it being in Southampton. But I just think everything around it, we're really looking forward to it. We're, you know, wanting to put the preparation in straight away. And I think having England and Austria in our World Cup qualifying group, I think that puts us in good stead.
Yeah, definitely. And your coach was saying earlier about you all coming together and going professional for a period of time. What is the next few months look like for you guys?
Yeah, the things are going on in the background to put that into place now, and hopefully from January onwards leading into the tournament, the girls at home will become full-time. And I think you've just got to look at, we played England at Wembley and for 65 minutes it was 0-0. And yes, fitness did tell in the end, and I think if our girls are given the opportunity to have that in place, be full-time, the preparation, we've got more time to do so, and the girls aren't going to work from 9 till 5, I think that gives us a chance to really compete and make a good account of ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually moved to Liverpool this year, so I've been coming to watch you at Prenton Park a lot. And I think every week you see more and more fans being there. Just the growth of women's football, do you feel really honoured to be a part of that and see how much is changing?
Yeah, I do. I think you've just got to look at the growth in England this year. Obviously, the WSL have got Sky Sports on board and all the other sponsors. And I just think that just shows the growth of women's football. For myself personally, the growth in Northern Ireland has been massive since we qualified for the tournament as well, and that's just going from strength to strength. And I know little girls and boys at home, you know, they were there midweek watching us, asking for our shirts, little boys and girls, and I just think that's fantastic to see, and we really are inspiring a younger generation, and I hope it continues.
Yeah, I think we'll see loads of fans there next year. Well, last one from a Liverpool perspective, how is everything at the moment? The mood seems to be really, we've got another home game this weekend, so to our listeners, trying to get them all to come down, so yeah, how is everything going?
Yeah, everything's going really well. We're having a really positive season, and I think the fans really helped with that. I think there was over 1,000 at the last home game, and you know, through COVID, fans were sorely missed. That's why I play football. I play football for the fans, you know. So I think it's massive. So hopefully they come down in the numbers on Sunday and support us.
Yeah, well, it's half term, isn't it? So hopefully you have lots there, and I'll be there supporting you guys. Can't wait to see you, and very exciting draw. But thanks so much for talking to us, Rachel.
No, thank you. Thanks.
And I am joined by Ryan Baldy to talk about his book, The Dream Factory, which follows on from his previous work about footballers who were deemed wonder kids who never quite made the grade. Instead, this one steps into the world of football's academies, both boys and girls / men's and women's, more focus on the men's side, but a really good chapter in there about how women's academies have shifted and trying to learn from where men's academies have gone wrong. Ryan, this is it's a book of highs and lows. We obviously know there's been a lot of negativity around academisation in general, FPPP being a problem, around some very, very, very dire goings on that the FA didn't deal with in time, and around in general what football does to young people if we're not careful. That has been the case. But in this book as well, you also tell us the stories of those who make it, how they make it, and of lots of pretty wonderful people who are working ever so hard to develop young footballers as people as much as the idea of them as assets.
Yeah, it's kind of a real sort of all-encompassing view. It's really kind of broad in scope, but I think I tried to sort of zoom in on some, as you mentioned, some of the personal stories. I think that's the best way to sort of tell the story of academies. So there's a historical element, so we follow the journey of academies as they develop from essentially from the Lillishall program into what we know today, all the sort of negatives that we're well aware of. I've delved deeply into them again through doing it through the personal stories of people I spoke with. But yeah, as you say, there are some hopeful moments in there too, and some quite inspirational figures, really. The people I've met, a lot of the coaches, I came away quite inspired by, because as I've been saying through most of the interviews that I've done around this book, the people whose feet touch the turf are the ones who really care. I think it's the system that is kind of built against the hopes of these young players in the large part, but the people doing the day-to-day work, the people whose feet touch the turf, really do care about the children they're entrusted with.
One of the things that struck me through the book, a theme that I think you're drawing out without absolutely slapping the reader across the face with, so maybe I shouldn't, is the personal development aspect, that what appears to be the through line for a lot of the stronger, more innovative, more well-rounded coaches is the commitment to the personal development. I found the chapter actually which praises the way in which Manchester United try to build a certain culture into the players themselves in every single aspect of what they do when they go on away on trips away and all that sort of stuff, what the expectations are for them, what the expectations are around the laundry women.
I found that to be really, really quite effective, to be honest with you. I was almost on the verge of being moved by it, which is something I can rarely say about Manchester United. But in terms of this, in terms of the idea that it's very much person orientated. And that to me, that appeared to be the through line for absolutely everybody, which sort of brings us on to talking about the Trent Arnold stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's an area of the game that I think academies in general across the board are starting to wake up to a little bit. They've got to, I think everyone's well aware now that the attrition rates are so high and that it is potentially a very damaging environment for young people if it goes wrong. So there's now a focus shifting towards making it enriching, an enriching experience regardless of the outcome. So there are people like Tony Whelan, who I spoke with the book at Man United, who that's been his kind of modus operandi for decades. He's been at United 30 years. He has a background in social care even before he got back into football coaching, and has PhDs about how to, you know, childcare and things like this. So he's a kind of pioneer of that aspect, but it is something that is developing across the board, and it is an encouraging development. And we see it at Liverpool as well. I use United as an example, essentially, of what's going on elsewhere. I was able to get access there, which was great, and I was able to tell that story. But it is just to kind of hold a light on the people doing this kind of really good work, which is happening elsewhere too.
It was. In amongst that, the stuff around Trent is fascinating. It's in your chapter, which refers to them as the platinum production line. You look at him and you look at Rashford. There's this desire from them to have almost looked to really test him, whilst there's an element of pastoral care underneath it. Like, they're almost wondering if he's going to be able to do this right back thing. You know, every single day they make it as difficult as they possibly can for him, give him everything he can possibly learn from, whilst they're continually, you know, Neil Critchley speaks about checking back in with conversations with him, all of this sort of stuff, to see that he's coping with it and he's enjoying the challenge. We now get to see the footballer, you know, on a regular basis, the footballer that he's become. But it is fascinating, isn't it, that they effectively really did create almost an assault course for him to learn how to be a right back.
Yeah, it was fascinating to learn that, speaking with Neil, who of course was, you know, on the front line of Alexander Arnold's development from a midfield playmaker into a right back that we see today, and the kind of gauntlet they threw at him on a day-to-day basis, and how, you know, he would fail. There would be times when he struggled. I wrote about how he would send balls sailing across the training pitches in frustration, how he could be a bit petulant at that age, but how Liverpool from the off ensured they had total buy-in from him, and how they kind of, I don't want to use the phrase sold the idea to him, but how they convinced him of their plan to redeploy him as a right back. You know, that was through conversations with Critchley, with Alex Inglethorpe, the academy manager, constant meetings, a lot of feedback, a lot of footage, a lot of stats, but also, you know, a real kind of pounding on the day-to-day basis on the training pitches, giving him these challenges. I opened that chapter with the scene of Critchley bellowing from the side of the pitch, get it Trent, because they're telling their wingers, they're lining their best wingers in the squad up with Trent and getting the ball out to him and just putting him through this gauntlet, like I said, and seeing if he can sink or swim, but at the same time giving him the support he needs to learn the lessons that he needs to learn, that trial and error process is something that any young player has to go through, and you'd rather they go through that on the training pitches as much as possible and in the youth ranks before they get to the first team, and, you know, they're ready to do that on a higher level.
There's a focus, a chapter that focuses around Liverpool Academy women's manager, Julie Grundy as well, where, again, one of the things that I sort of took from it, and I don't mean this, so I've mentioned Liverpool and I've mentioned Manchester United, but for instance, through your case studies, Kidderminster at one point comes up, Colchester at one point comes up. But one of the things that sort of hits me, Julie talks about, you know, effectively how it became different for her when she realised she was working for, as she frames it, the biggest football club in the world. But one of the things that hits me around a lot of this is that ultimately this first challenge here is cultural. That the distinct case studies that you have that are hugely positive ones are ones where they're able to talk about a distinct culture, set of decisions that have been made in advance of any young player coming through, whether that's to build the player into the system or, as in, I think it's Kidderminster's case, to do it the other way around and build the systems around the players because they're there purely for player development and we work this stuff out as we go. It seems, though, that the clubs that have got the academisation stuff sorted at any level of the game, either gender, they're the ones who've got a really clear sense of what football club they are and what sort of players it is they're trying to produce.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was so interesting about meeting Julie Judy rather, is I had the pleasure of going up and spending an evening with her and just watching her work and just seeing how Liverpool's academy operates on a nightly basis. And it was in the middle of COVID. I think it was around November time last year, so we had just come out of the latest lockdown that we were in, and we were still under quite strict restrictions. And at the time, boys football at academy level was deemed an elite sporting activity, whereas girls wasn't. So that was a really interesting sort of window into the inequality that the game still has between the genders. So, to speak to Julie, who's someone who has deep reverence for the history of women's football, who's starkly aware of the difficulties that women in her sport have overcome, that, you know, that she stands on the shoulders of the people who came before her, the pioneers who sought to have this game, it was essentially outlawed for 50 years in this country. It was brought back and it's still playing catch up to an extent. And she was deeply reverent of that past, but also of Liverpool Football Club's past as well. So she spoke about how this great new academy complex, multi-million pound complex, was built essentially by the likes of Steven Gerrard and Jamie Carragher and Robbie Fowler. She was somebody who was really historically aware, and that comes through in her work. And I think it comes through in the general day-to-day work of Liverpool's academy. You stroll the academy grounds and hanging from every lamppost is a banner with the picture and the name of a Liverpool legend on it. So it's really interesting to see how the club kind of imbues their youth development program and use their young footballers with a sense of what it means to be a Liverpool player and what sort of lineage you're coming from and representing.
Well, it's excellent. The book is absolutely excellent. Ryan Baldy, The Dream Factory, Inside the Make or Break World of Football's Academies. It is on Polaris. If you want to find that, you can find Ryan on Twitter, Ryan Baldy FW on there. You can buy the book from other places that you buy books from. It is a book very much worth buying and very, very, very much worth reading. As is often the case with these things, if you subscribe to the Anfield Wrap-Up, we'll be having a longer chat with Ryan across the next few days. That'll be out for you as a subscriber show, getting into more of the issues stuff around the book. But it is a book that is very, very thought-provoking indeed. So do check it out. It's on Polaris, like I said, polarispublishing.com, The Dream Factory by Ryan Baldy. Great stuff there from Ryan and from Harriet and from Rachel and from Michael and from John. And I thought I was all right as well on the early part. Let's get back over now and hear from Emma Sanders, Damian Kavanagh and John Gibbons back in Tour Live. But if you're stuck with us and you've stuck with us on Tour Live, we'll be back now and we will talk to Damian and to Emma about the game coming up at West Ham United. I always say it, John, I think I stole it from Adam Melia, but I love it. He packs his lunch in a sunblessed bag. The children call him Moisey. He is doing an excellent job at West Ham. He deserves a ton of credit, to be honest with you, and I think we can all be magnanimous enough to give him that credit. It's remarkably impressive what he's done. It really, really is, and it shows what he can do with a group of footballers who suit him when he gets a bit of time with them. I'm stunned how effusive in my praise I keep being about David Moyes. I never thought I would see the day.
There wasn't even a 1 second break this week, by the way. We were straight in there. Poor Andy's gonna have to shoehorn a crowbar those segments in there. He's just done a time on it. Moyes, maybe he is a football genius after all. The cop called it first. They used to sort of sing it. He's done really well. The thing he's got them doing is which is quite a basic thing, but you know, they're enjoying it, aren't they? They're enjoying the football. They're enjoying each other. The team spirit seems fantastic.
It really does.
You know, and whenever there's players out, they seem to sort of still find a way. So whenever they've got injuries, I always think, oh, sort of, here we go, you know, especially with, you know, forwards out and things like that. But other guys sort of seem to be sort of, you know, able to come in and do the business for them. And, you know, they're doing really well. And as you say, Neil, Moyes deserves a lot of credit for that. I don't think they've beat a team as good as Liverpool so far this season. So I think it will be, you know, a big test for them. But they've certainly picked up a lot of points so far. And we'll have to be pretty close to our best to win on this Sunday, I reckon.
With them, Damien, they're playing tonight, so let's be crystal clear. They haven't played against Genk yet. That's to come, and it's really in their interest to get through, because if you're first, you guarantee the place in the last 16 in the Europa League now. Second,
whoever finishes second, they all play the teams that drop down from the Champions League. So it's always, so there's, they don't want that West Ham. If they win tonight, they're absolutely guaranteed that they will come first in that group. So I think you'll play a relatively strong side against Genk. So we've got to be clear that, you know, that they've got that game in. So there'll be five or six who'll be playing both matches from the West Ham point of view. But it won't include Mikel Antonio almost certainly. He's been looking after him a little bit over the course of the season. Mm. And he's been managing his squad brilliantly to be 9 points out of nine in any group, you know, which is where they are with the Europa League, is excellent. To be fourth in the Premier League, excellent. They've beaten both Manchester teams in the Carabao Cup, excellent. It's an excellent season. It really is for them so far. And we've got a task, I think, on Sunday, stopping West Ham, stopping Antonio, derailing that excellent momentum that they've got.
Yeah, you can only give them 10 out of 10, can't you? Right? You know,
very much so.
Oh, yeah, and the Moyes thing, you know, I get it. You know, if you look at what the job he did at Everton, you know, and I don't want to be patronised about it because it's not. If you look at the expectations that were on Everton when he took over and where he took them, they were a real danger, weren't they? And they were knocking on that door about getting into the Champions League.
They were a shambles when he took over. I remember.
And I actually think part of the reason he got the gig was the fact that he was a manager in the Championship, and hadn't he gone down, he had the experience there as well. I think it was that, you know, Everton were that bad at the time, but he made them into a real force, you know, with a real thorn in anyone's side. And I know he didn't win away to the bigger ones, but you know, there's a budget there and that, and it's when he's given a different deck of cards that wasn't playing to his strengths, but to be organised, to be difficult to beat, team spirit, players knowing the roles, capitalising on another team making a mistake, you know, because they underestimate them, that's all David Moyes. And so he's got a platform here at West Ham for that to flourish, because that's the gig, you know. And if West Ham finish, roughly speaking, where they are now, or a place or two lower, then he'll be noted as a success, and quite rightly too. And as for Europe, I never get why teams want to finish high up in the league to qualify for Europe and then throw themselves out of it at the first opportunity, because it's called the Europa League. What realistically for West Ham would be a successful season in Europe? Well, I tell you what, they're in probably the strongest league in Europe, and they're right up there pushing at the top. It's glory time, isn't it? I mean, you know, there'll be a statue to this fella if he wins that Europa League. And there'll be statues to those players. And it'll be another thing. So why not roll all that positivity and sort of like just enjoy and embrace it? I mean, I loved Liverpool's run to the UEFA Cup final under Klopp. It was great. And so going back to it, Moyes deserves all the credit. And we've got our hands full, no question about it. But just watching Liverpool last night and knowing what they can do, I think West Ham will know that they're going to be playing a team at a different level now. And we've got to just go there and do the business. And if we concentrate on ourselves, it'll be 3 points.
I've just said live, Emma, that Antonio won't play the Europa League game. He has been picked to play the Europa League game. first foot Moyes has put wrong, as far as I'm concerned, in age. Just made a show of me.
He's got you on the back foot already.
Oh, now. God. I feel as though we've lost the toss, John.
He did it to prove we were live.
Oh, good God. He's picked Rice. He's picked Benrahma. He's picked a couple of others who I think would feature against us. Koufal, maybe. Oh, yeah. But he's been picking Ben Johnson recently. Creswell will finish again. We'll start against us as well. So he's got four or five in there who will start against us. But as Damien's saying, and the thing to firstly, I spoke to a West Ham supporter earlier, and he pointed out they've got a lot of big games in December. They will want the Europa League to be finished from their point of view and parked until they get into next February. But as part of all of this, as Damien says, the idea of them taking that competition seriously, I think it's hugely important. It is as likely a route as any to get into playing in the Champions League. But also, as Damien says, the idea of your supporters enjoying themselves. We're going to be dealing a point here on Sunday, I think, every chance, with a very buoyant West Ham crowd. They should be buoyant. It's 4:30 on a Sunday. It's a massive game. They're playing Liverpool. And I think we're going to have to really, as Damien says, we're really going to have our hands full. It's going to be noisy. It's going to be rowdy. They're going to be confident. They're going to love their footballers, because at the minute, those footballers, they're worth loving. They love each other. The togetherness there at the minute is unprecedented in the last 10 years at West Ham. It really is.
Yeah, the feeling is just so good there. You know, you speak to anyone associated with the club and everyone's, you know, all they can say is that they're just really enjoying it. And yeah, kind of, you know, back to the European point. I mean, it's not only just about obviously getting the qualification for the Champions League, but they've got a very, very good chance of winning an actual trophy, like a very, very well-respected trophy. So, you know, I think Vladimir Sufal actually said earlier this week that if they can, you know, get the job done in the Europa League, then it'll be a bonus, was the word that he used. And I think that shows you kind of how far West Ham have come, that they're already thinking about the bigger picture in terms of challenging in multiple competitions. You know, that's not something that they would have thought about before. But the fact that, you know, they've got it so ingrained in their head that they need to win tonight, and therefore they, you know, they've got the bonus of avoiding that kind of playoff and just getting through to the knockout stages of the Europa League, so that they can turn their full attentions to the Premier League. And I think that mentality is something that's growing at West Ham. They know now that they can compete with the top teams, and they know that they are starting to put pressure on. They're only 2 points behind Liverpool. They can overtake them with a win on the weekend. They're right up there, obviously, with Manchester City. You know, they're fourth in the table, so why not go for it? Absolutely, they've got everything to go for. But yeah, I just say, from Liverpool's point of view, I think it's just a case of kind of reminding them really that while they're, you know, kind of in this honeymoon period and they're on a roll and it's great for them, what Liverpool have built over time is a kind of a stature that West Ham aren't anywhere near yet, and that's what Liverpool need to do, is just remind them and say, look, we are Liverpool, you're playing this, and this is what it means to play a real elite team.
We had results and performance last night against Madrid, John. I felt Liverpool, after the Brighton game, needed in either last night against Madrid or this one coming up against West Ham, to put a performance in. They obviously needed to get two results as well, but it was nice. I wanted at least a performance in one of them. I think a similar sort of performance against West Ham is the sort of thing that West Ham will struggle a teeny bit to cope with. I think Liverpool can grab control of this game, given the way in which West Ham set up. They also like to try to play a little bit on the counter. We're going to have to be really sharp in transition and all of that sort of stuff coming up against this West Ham side. But for me, this is a game where last season when we went there, it finishes 3-0, but it's a very even game for about 55 minutes. We've got to grab this one, I think, by the scruff of the neck early, because I think the more time we give them to believe, to grow, the more I think you'll get that crowd up. Those players will be looking at one another. First half an hour is big for the Reds.
It is, yeah, and I hope they approach it in a similar way to last night, because, you know, we were all frustrated by the Brighton game, but, you know, it was sort of hard to put a finger on what was wrong, really. You just knew it wasn't right. And then when last night they're playing with that intensity, they're playing with that cutting edge, you're like, yeah, this is what the real Liverpool, you know, look like. You know, we've stood up here and shown absolutely what we're about. And, you know, it was sort of, you know, night and day from that performance to sort of how we finished up against Brighton, which was a bit sort of lifeless and a bit clueless, really. Well, they were sharp in mind and body last night, where they were first to everything, and they were you know, smarter, you know, than the opposition sort of as well, really, and then able to sort of kill the game when it suited us too, which there'll probably have to be a little bit of that, you know, on Sunday, because you can't just blow a team away. Certainly not a good one, you know, not for 90 minutes. You can blow a team away for 15, 20 and get ahead, but there will be at some point they'll need to show control, but they showed plenty of that last night as well. So we've got it in us. We just need to go again, you know, dust ourselves off. A couple might need a couple of bandages or a bit of strapping or whatever, but just go again. It's a big game Sunday, but I think they can do it.
I think there's a chance. I'm not saying this will happen. I'm not even saying it's the likelier thing to happen, but there's a fair chance, John, he goes unchanged.
Yeah, there is a good chance of that. I mean, the front three, he'll more or less have to, I think, because obviously Bobby comes on and then sort of gets injured. Midfield, we've not got a ton of options. I don't know whether he might just think it's one game too far for Chamberlain. You know, Chamberlain goes off and the manager says after that, he wasn't injured, but he took some knocks and you know, he's played quite a lot of football.
Because he's at Preston as well. He got the full 90 against Preston pretty much.
Yeah. So Preston on the back of Brighton and then this one. I think he'd be tempted to go Thiago in this one, with Thiago getting sort of a nice 20 minutes and maybe even just asking for an hour for him. You know, Fabinho gets the hour, doesn't he? It's a very planned sub. I think it's 59:57 he gets. so just before the hour.
Like, as an alarm on his phone.
Honestly, yeah. Turned into a pumpkin if he was on for 60, exactly. You know, that would have been when Sunday in mind. So Fabinho will go again. Obviously, the captain, he'll ask to go again. And I just think he might go for Thiago just because, you know, he'll be aware of what's in Chamberlain's legs. But, you know, they'll be, you know, he'll be on the bench and a good option.
What do you think he does, Emma? There's a bit of movement. Possibly he could do it centre-half. Obviously, there's the left-back question, as John just sort of said there, midfield. I think it will be the same front three. I'd be surprised if he deviates from that. I don't see an unlikely Origi or anything like that getting dropped in. But, you know, yeah, you've seen the manager pull some stuff in the past. What do you think he does?
You know what? This might be a bit of a curveball, but I wouldn't be surprised if Konate comes in for Matip, just because of that, a bit of physicality and a bit of height, because West Ham, I think I saw a comment earlier. Sorry, I can't remember.
There was, yeah.
Somebody mentioned the height of West Ham, and I thought that was a really good point. Actually, I think Konate, just to kind of put his body about, might be brought in for that. Klopp obviously trusts him, obviously played him in the Man United game. So I wouldn't be surprised if he came in. Personally, you know, I'd be happy either way. I'd probably go for Matip. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Konate comes in. And I do think Robertson probably will get the nod ahead of Jimmy Cass. But the rest, I think, will be the same, yeah. Apart from maybe Thiago in midfield.
Ian Turner, it was, who said that the size of West Ham worries him a little, Damien. They are a big side. In the middle of the park there, you've got Souček and Rice, absolute units. Obviously, the two centre-halves are big lads. Bowen, powerful footballer. Soufal, if he starts, is a bit of a unit as well. And obviously, Antonio. It will be a physical challenge, I think, for Liverpool, Damien. How do you think we're going to get on?
I'm backing us. You know, I think, you know, the result last night is just going to show Liverpool that he can take on anybody, I think. And I think the point about us getting control early is a very good one, because if the fans are bouncing, they're having a great time, and they can get, you know, the team can start, you know, getting a few digs in and getting a bit of joy here and there and getting a corner and getting a free kick and going close on goal. You know, all of a sudden it grows and grows and grows. So they can be 7'12" if they like, if they haven't got the ball. So it's about us controlling it, and it's about us doing that, you know, and about us playing to our strengths. I like the idea that you've been in a position where we're actually saying, of course, and you know, who would you swap Andy Robertson for? Nobody. But we're actually thinking there's a deputy there who we can put him in here. And then, you know, I'd have been astonished about Konate if that stunt wasn't pulled at Old Trafford, and all of a sudden, like, great. You know, and I've never seen a player make Virgil look average height, because it's that physical presence, you know, and you think, well, what did we sign him for? And we possibly lost a little bit when he was playing against Brighton, because he's not going to bring the ball out like Matip would. So if they weigh it up and sort of say, well, you know, I want someone whose head's about as high as the crossbar, because West Ham are going to try and bomb us, then Konate is someone I would use. And I would, and then by that definition, then I'll put Thiago in, because I say, well, okay, we'll control the ball more from there. They're the little adjustments, but you've got, you know, agreeing with everyone on here, the little options that we've got, I've got no objections to any of them.
Are we going to get on?
I think we'll win. I think it'll be hard. But I think, you know, on the back of Wednesday's performance, I think they'll ride that into the international break. And I think they'll be disappointed with last Saturday, and we'll know that's a couple dropped. But if they can win against West Ham, I think that redeems that. It gives us 10 points, you know, from this little chunk going into international break, which is perfectly fine. So, yeah, I think there'll be determination to do it. And when the side are determined, there's normally no stopping them.
Emma, fancy us?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Gibbo's just said. I think it'll be close again. But yeah, I'm going 1-0 Liverpool, I think.
You don't get many 1-0 Liverpools these days, but I like that as well, Emma. I think it might be a very, very nervy last 10 minutes for the Reds, but I think that Liverpool can see this one out, and that's the way it will work. I mean, I said this about the United game, to be honest with you, so don't listen to me. But I think Liverpool will have to suffer against West Ham for a period of time. Using the manager's language, there will be a period of time where they have to suffer a little bit. But I think Liverpool will just about do the business as well. Thank you very much indeed to Michael McCambridge, Harry Pryor, Rachel Furness, Ryan Baldy, and John Gibbons, Emma Sanders, Damien Cavanagh. I've been Neil Atkinson. It's been Your Tour Live this week. Whatever you're doing, have a fantastic weekend. I'm talking about the Odyssey in Calderstones Park at 3 p.m. on Saturday, if you fancy that kind of thing. The Saturday 3 o'clock's are rubbish as well, though. Emma's probably going to do live text for them, so, you know, feel sorry for her. Thank you very much to everyone. It's been Tour Live. See you later.
Sports Social Podcast Network.